I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. We go to Sointula for this next conversation. I reached John Taylor back in June to talk about his memoir, Fried Eggs and Fish Scales, Tales from a Sointula Troller. As you'll hear, I begin the interview by placing where Sointula is. It's a place at the northeastern end of Vancouver Island. It's on Malcolm Island, and John's own family history there extends back to the early part of the 20th century. His Finnish grandparents had planned to join the other Finns who'd moved there to found their own workers' paradise. However, on seeing the island, they moved back to Cuba. John moved there in 1976, and it's fascinating to read of the lifestyle and what he did to make a living. We read about the rollicking commercial fishery, island life, John's years as a fisherman and boat builder, as well as the memorable people that he tells us about throughout the book. It's a memorable book, as is John, whose ability to tell a good story on the page or over the phone are joys to behold. John Taylor is a retired fisherman and boat builder. He is a lifelong writer of poetry, memoir, essays, and fiction, and he is an avid musician. We taped this interview in early June. This book is from Harbor Publishing. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, John Taylor. Mr. Taylor, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Thanks for joining us. Have I reached you in Sointula?
I'm in Sointula, about 6 kilometers just outside of town.
So I'm in Vancouver. If I were to make it up there, how long a trip is it, and how would I get there?
Painfully. once you got to the ferries on your side of the world,
yeah.
Then of course you have to take the ferry across, and presumably you would want to end up in Nanaimo or DuPont. And then you would drive about 5 hours north to Port McNeil. And in Port McNeil, you would get on another ferry and cross over to Malcolm Island.
How often does that ferry run to Malcolm Island?
Oh, there's a few a day. And it's not like the old days. Every couple of hours.
I see. Yeah.
And
how many of you number living there in Sointula?
Nowadays, it's down to about 500, I think. 45 years ago, there was maybe 800, a little more, on the island. But there's not much work, and all the young people have, moved away and so on and so forth.
Yeah, so it comes across in the book as a not just an interesting place to live, but just a bucolic, lovely place to live. And I guess is that part of what's kept you there all these years?
Yeah, I've lived in various places in the world, and this place was just culturally more comfortable than anywhere else I've been. I have a Finnish background,
mm-hmm.
and the culture here was just fit me just fine, and I like that. All small towns, all small demographics have a lot of extremes in them, and you kind of tend to accept a little more, difference between people, and so you can, the guy down the street who literally used to wear a stainless steel bowl on his head is really a very nice guy, and he just has, a few issues, and other people, it's similar. I think we're forced to accept the differences that everybody has.
Yeah, I'm reading about a lot of the people that you live amongst in
yeah.
the book, and it seems that patience is something that you have to have in living in a small town that perhaps we in the city don't have as much of.
Well, patience, yeah, more in the industrial realm.
Mm.
If you want to order a part for something, I used to do auto repairs years back, and
uh-huh.
I'd figure that it would take 2 or 3 orders before I'd get the right part. It's not quite that way anymore, but that would be it. And, if you want it tomorrow, you can't get it.
Yeah.
You have to, and if the store doesn't have it, we have only the one store, then you either have to pay to go across on the ferry and get it and hope that they have it in Port McNeil, which they may not.
Yeah. What's the weather like in Vancouver? We're talking here in early June, and it's warm in Vancouver the day that I'm talking to you. What's it like there right now?
Well, at the very moment, I have my front door propped open because there's sunshine. We refer to June as January or something like that because June is one of our wetter months. Mm-hmm. And the standard joke is, of course, that we have 9 months of winter and 3 months of damn late in the fall. the first 30 years I was here, I think I saw 30 degrees twice.
Wow. Yeah.
A couple of years ago, we had, I think, 4 days in a row that hit 30, and, of course, everybody sat in the corner and died.
You mentioned your Finnish background.
Right.
I guess Scandinavians, did they land there in the early part of the 20th century? Is that right?
About 1900, a fella named Matti Kurikka wanted to set up a utopian colony where everybody would share and, you know, do all the nice stuff that utopias do. And so they got a grant from the government if they could have the place, Malcolm Island here. They didn't worry about the fact that some indigenous people might want it who had been living here, but they weren't on the island at the moment. So the bunch of Finns came in, and this was all purely a Finnish community. And even 40 years ago, they had to have somebody on the till in the store who could speak Finnish. That's not true anymore.
Yeah.
And but there's still quite a few people around who do. And my family, my mother's family, came here, wanted to come here in 1917. And they were part of another Finnish group. But when they got here, they found out that it was no longer the utopian colony. It was now a free love community, which, you know, they didn't do. So they went to join with Kurikka on another one of his adventures, but he died before he got there. So, you know, it's the Finnish thing is still very strong here. And in Finland, there's a very popular play called Sointula. Everybody knows about it. It's Finland's only overseas colony, they say.
Hmm. And so it seems as I'm reading the book that it would be inevitable that you'd end up there. but you know, as I'm reading the book and I'm seeing how you're describing it and everything that you've experienced there, it just seems like to have fit almost like fate, I guess.
Well, I don't use the phrase myself, but for years ago they used to call it Malcolm Island magic. And it happened to me where I had a 3-year-old, a very pregnant wife, and a large dog in the front seat of a pickup truck, and I was headed for Port Hardy to visit a friend and saw the sign Sointula on the side of the road and thought, oh, I've heard about it all my life because my mother's family was going to come here, and so I have to see it. And we got halfway across on the ferry, and we looked at it and said, yeah, we'll move here, and did, and I've been here ever since.
Yeah. Are there a lot of people that like you, from time to time, move up there, say?
Well, there's a funny cycle that we get. An awful lot of people who, you know, bought a house, you know, 40 years ago in Vancouver, and now they're millionaires, want to sell and cash in and move somewhere. And they get the idea that this island is one of the Gulf Islands.
Mm.
Technically, it is. It is nothing even remotely like a Gulf Island. Up until very recently, it was a normal working island. Everybody worked, everybody fished, logging, so on and so forth. And, like, if you needed room to spread out your nets or something, you could go down to the parking lot, the one at the harbor, and take over the whole parking lot to work on your nets.
Yeah.
It was quite normal. You know, accidentally blocking roads because you're moving something, well, that was, you know, nobody worried about it because everybody did it. So, The people who come in, it's very often, with exceptions, of course, a 2-year cycle. They come in all hot to enjoy the country life. First thing they want to do is change everything so it's like the city, you know, put up lights and all this and have this and have that. And then they realize that nobody's talking to them and they leave.
Yeah.
So The odd group of people have come in and become really, you know, part of the heart of the community, but an awful lot of them just kind of drift through and don't make contact on the way.
Yeah, you talk in the book about the occasional tensions that come up, and firewood is a central theme, I guess, in terms of what divides people, right?
Well, that was one bad incident there. Everybody cuts firewood on the beach, and at one point the forestry said we weren't allowed to, and we said, well, yeah, okay, that's fine, and kept right on cutting firewood, and then they stopped saying it. And it's very common to cut a big load of firewood and leave it stacked by the side of the road, and it will not disappear. I've seen piles sit there till they rotted, but there was an occasion where there was a guy on the island moved here and started not only stealing it but selling it.
Mm-hmm.
That went very badly for him. A bunch of the local boys spoke to him rather harshly about it, and he decided it would be a good thing to move off the island. It was a bit sad. He had a wife and kid and so on, but he just was into stealing everything he could find. So when the morning he was leaving, some of the local boys met him and went through all of his belongings to reclaim what they thought was theirs.
Mm.
He never came back. And there's been a couple of refugees, I'll say, from the city. People think that going to hide out in a small town makes you invisible.
Mm.
Well, of course, you couldn't possibly be more visible. So we get the odd, you know, I hate to phrase it that way, but lost souls who really want a different life than what they have in the city and really believe that there's something out here for them. But, you know, you have to be pretty self-reliant and able to entertain yourself and to make friends.
Yeah.
If you want to live in a small town like this.
You talk in the book of one guy who, I guess he looked down on people from small towns, and he thought that he could trick them. And this was a guy who was taking money from a bank all the way up to.
Oh yeah.
You know.
Yeah. No, he stayed forever.
Yeah.
He died a little while back, but what did they call that, Bank AmeriCard or something, when
sure.
It first came out?
Yeah.
And they sent them to everybody, you know, and they sent them to kids, they sent them to the family pet, and so he was had a very good position down in the city and was an expert in his field, which was antique firearms, and he got the card and said he wanted to be a cowboy, and like I said in the thing there, he went the wrong way. If he'd gone north or east, he would have been fine, but he went west. And in those days, if you took out less than $50, they didn't check that you could do it. So he simply went bank to bank, and I forget what it was, $48 or $49 that he took, and ended up here and came across on the ferry and threw the card overboard, and nobody ever knew who it was. But he did stay here for a long time.
Yeah.
And he used to periodically get called to court to testify in his field of expertise. He was he was good at it. Other than being, you know, the usual alcoholic and crazy, he was quite an interesting person. He was a good musician also, and he used to go up to like Cache Creek and whatnot for gigs and, you know, play, sit in the bar and play, you know, country western music.
Yeah.
But he's the one that also had the horse that would take him home no matter what.
So many memorable characters in the book, and a lot of them are people we meet through your stories about working on the boat. And you mentioned booze just a minute ago, just a second ago here. There's a lot of drinking that goes on these ships, isn't there?
Well, yes and no. Some boats are dry.
Uh-huh.
Some boats are piss tanks. And others, it's like on my boat, in the evening after, if we were anchored out somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, everything's down, everything's secure, the weather report is good. You know, one shot of liquor to, you know, go to sleep with was quite acceptable. But there was never a point at which it was reasonable to be in any form incapacitated.
Mm-hmm.
On their boats, they were, you know, totally plastered every day.
Yeah, so how did you deal with, say, drunks who would be part of the crew, or just lazy people in general? Because, I mean, you know, you're a group of people who have a job, supposedly. But there's some people who, you know, slack off, right?
Yeah, there is that problem. You have to, not so much in Soinfilla, but over in Ord Bay, the thing was, they were a lot of seine boats. And if the guy was on board the boat, he was considered to be crew.
Mm.
And even if he spent 3 days in the bunk with a horrendous hangover, he was still crew. Whereas if you missed the boat, you weren't crew anymore. So there was that. A lot of times, you know, it was families and, well, give Bobby a chance and
sure.
and that kind of stuff. And it generally worked out. In my own boats, I never had any problem because I tended to hire very nice people who worked very hard because we're trying to make money for ourselves.
And I don't know why this surprised me, John, but over the years, the crews on your boats were not just men, were they?
No, I had both. Depending on the fishery, if it was salmon, sockeye salmon mainly,
mm-hmm.
then I would need two crew members, and if it was just the rock cod fishery, I normally only had one, although I sometimes took two. And I just get along better with women. And I'm okay, one doesn't say that out loud anymore, right? but I find that when you're the skipper of a boat, you have to be in charge. You know, there's no choice. And somebody has to be in charge, and it has to be, since it's my boat, it's me. I hired women who were absolutely capable of running the boat sometimes. But everybody understands that, you know, when the skipper yells something has to be done quick, it's got to be done quick.
Yeah.
And there was no, you know, privacy is something that you don't claim for yourself. It's something other people give you.
Mm.
And in a small boat, you know, it's all small boats are, you know, 40-foot boat is, fish boat is quite small. You simply have to be blind and deaf and realistic so that if somebody's changing their clothes, you don't see.
Mm, right.
You know, it's not a, there is no issue about, at least with anybody in the crew that I had, absolutely no issue about the close physical proximity, and we were there to work. And if we were not there to fool around.
You mentioned a moment ago sockeye, and we read about that in the book. To fish that, I guess, there's a certain season, there's a certain time of the year that you do that, right? Is that the same with rock cod?
And no, well, it depends what the DFO is doing.
I see.
Rock cod used to be a year-round fishery, and then they said, okay, we'll start it like April 1st and run it through December. We don't know why. The science on the rock cod has been so grotesquely misused and abused that nobody knows what's happening. But at any rate, so we would go out and set up a fish camp, and then we would fish our rock cod, which we then kept live in pens in the boat and then in the camp, and then we would transfer it to a truck to be driven down to Chinatown where it was sold live.
Again,
very, very high-end fish. And that's what I did most of my fishing. And then when I finally was able to get a salmon license, because it's very expensive to get the license, then I started fishing sockeye. And I'm not the world's greatest fisherman. I had some good days and made some money, but nothing like the highliners who were, you know, pulling in vast amounts of money. I had one best sockeye day I ever had.
Uh-huh.
I found a corner of a an area that was open, and there was nobody else there but me, and my daughter was with me, and we were making, call it $2,500 an hour.
Really?
All day.
Yeah.
And she was earning her money for going back to university. And so on, and as soon as she had enough, she was counting the fish. She's, okay, we can go in now. No, I want to go in now.
Yeah. Is there I don't know how to ask this, John, but does luck play a part into catching fish?
Luck?
Yeah.
Well, it depends where you assign the luck. There are people who catch fish, just insane amount of fish. Where they go, they get fish, and some of them are really nice people, and some of them are animals. And then there's a whole lot of guys who, those people seem to get it just because they're there. Other guys work and work in order to be highliners. And they get their fish, but boy, do they work for it. And then people like me, I just used to go out and knew some good spots, and I did all right. I was middle of the fleet a lot of times, and lower middle of the fleet some other times. So there is a huge amount with modern electronics. When you can hit certain spots over and over again, that makes a difference. And I learned to do that on the rockcod fishery very well. But in sockeye, or in salmon in general, mm-hmm. sockeye was the only one that we really tried much on. There's the old traditional spots, which sometimes work. And then there's oddball spots where, you know, with less competition, you can pick up a nice lot of fish. But someplace like Robson Bight, where there, you know, there might be 150 boats going in the circle, and every boat pulling fish as fast as it can go, it's quite the show when it happens. But yeah, that's only every few years.
Yeah, you mentioned these fish camps where you'd store the fish. You'd have to build those, I guess. What are some of the challenges? Because there's some funny stories about the fish camps in the book. But, you know, there's certain challenges from, say, seals or mink.
Yeah.
Terms of, because, you know, they're interested in fish too.
There was problems there. Actually, otters were the ones that got me most often. The material you build, the pen that is in the water. This is the pen where when you come in from fishing, you throw your live fish into this pen. And contrary to what the DFO says, they're perfectly happy living there for months if you leave them there. But anyway, so there's these plastic materials. There's some kind of mesh called Vexar that none of the animals can eat through.
Mm-hmm.
And you make a lid that closes, so on and so forth, and it keeps the seals and the otters and the mink out. It's very sad. If one of them does get in, they often drown. The pens are completely underwater. But that was a very, very rare occurrence. And then once in a while, there would be a seal that would come in, and there's like anywhere from, I suppose, 8 to 25 of us there with pens in the water that would start literally attacking the pens, and somebody would shoot the seal. But that was a very, very rare occurrence, and so there's a lot of fish in the water there. We also have supplied by our fish buyer a great big tote full of ice that we put the dead fish in.
Mm-hmm.
The good dead fish. And we would sell that if people came in and wanted fish, we would sell from the dead fish, or at the going rate of the live ones. It was really expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, before I was out of the fishery, it was up to about $12 a pound for 2-pound fish.
Really? Well, Do you fish? Do you fish still? Still, I mean, not in terms of say work, but just for leisure.
Never have in my life.
Really?
When I was a kid, my neighbor taught me how to do trout fishing and whatnot. But right now, when I was trolling, I would be towing, I believe it was 108 hooks at a time with lures. And I feel so stupid going out and dropping a line down with one hook on it. I go, what am I doing here?
Yeah.
And this is the same thing with rock cod.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know where I can go and catch a rock cod tomorrow. But again, going all that way to lower down one hook, and I forget how many I'm allowed to keep now, two or three. Why would I do that?
You talk in the book about the fishery itself as work as a business. You talk also in the book about sustainability, and there is a huge demand for fish still, and at the same time, the fishery itself is not what it was, say, like in the 1970s, which you describe as the glory days. What do you make of say, our consumption of fish and where it ends up and who consumes it, and you contrast that with what it's like to make a living, say, in that business?
Well, the problem now, you know, I'm not prejudiced or anything, right, or opinionated. the problem is the DFO, the Department of Fisheries. Fish don't vote, minerals don't vote, trees don't vote, but they put politicians in charge of all of them, and they make all their decisions politically. I once managed to grab a couple hours alone with Brian Peckford, who was responsible for the East Coast problems, declaring that there was, 60 million fish to be caught, where in fact the scientists said there was 6 million and that they should not be caught. And he just said, well, it was a mistake. It was political, but it was a mistake. They moved the decimal point, six things to the right. And so over and over again here, as the group of fishermen, we fought to have areas closed. We have fought to have limitations. Mm. And that never makes the news. But we did it, and I did it, and I drew maps, and I presented things to DFO. And to say they lied point blank is an understatement. They lied point blank about what they were doing, what they intended, how they were going to go about it. The people know who they are. That's how they make their living. And they say, well, they have to in order to keep their job.
Mm-hmm.
And, these were conversations I had. This is ancient history now. But it was a little bit shocking the first time to, be railroaded like that. And it happened in both salmon and in rock cod. So the boats, if you're fishing rock cod and you get another type of fish, you're required to throw it back overboard, whether it's going to live or not.
Mm.
So I have, and also, like a red snapper floats if it's been pulled to the surface, it can't go back down.
Mm-hmm.
So I have followed a boat that was licensed to fish dogfish, and it was throwing a trail of snappers behind it that it couldn't allow to. Those fish are worth $20 a piece.
Yeah.
And nowadays, nowadays they were $60 a piece. And I'm not legally, even though I have a license to have them, I'm not legally allowed to pick them up. Mm-hmm. So here's this vast, vast waste of fish that the government requires you to do.
Yeah.
And it simply goes on from there. We were not allowed to keep halibut. Now we were not. We didn't get many halibut. We certainly got occasional halibut.
Sure.
They last pretty well. They come to the surface. You get the hook out, and they go away. But your other bottom feeding fish just can't do it. And so you throw away pound after pound of delicious, good, nutritious fish.
Yeah.
And so the again, it's the politics of the thing. We had the big run of sockeye come through one year, and in that run, they estimated that there was out of like 6 million fish, they thought that there would be 12 fish that might go to Cultus Lake. And Cultus Lake is in super danger. It's going to be wiped out. And so we sent a bunch of guys to Ottawa to talk to the Minister of Fisheries saying, hey, you know, this is just not acceptable. There's all this fish going through. The rivers won't take it all because there's no room in the beds.
Yeah.
Let us fish. And the guy said, well, that's ridiculous. Because every time anybody catches one of those Cultus Lake fish, they should just throw it back.
Huh.
Well, out of a few million sockeye, it's real difficult to tell which one was going to head to Cultus Lake. You know?
Yeah.
But that was the response. Now, we agree with you completely. This is silly. And you're just listening to these people who have no idea what's happening. And at one point, I had a weekly meeting with Fred. What was his name? Anyhow, he was second to... he was Minister of Fisheries for the West Coast underneath the head minister. And we had a weekly meeting where he'd call up and say, okay, we're releasing, how is it being taken? And I said, well, they're laughing at you, this kind of thing. And he said, no, and he gets angry. You know, no, that's not what we know what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to do this and that. So you've made a law that says this. That's what we're doing, but it won't work because blah, blah, blah. And they would just get angry that their plans did not turn out the way they wanted them to, but of course they hadn't asked anybody about it. So, you know, you sit there and I just want to cry.
Yeah.
And I avoid these days, especially I avoid talking about the fisheries and the disaster because politicians would seem to, be able to screw up anything they touch. And I have not yet seen a wise move. One of the local groups of indigenous people here went up to, there was a place up in the mainland. They went to clean up a log jam that was stopping the salmon from going up the stream.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all arrested for disturbing the log jam.
Because
you know, the police went in and no, you can't create a better salmon stream here. Because there's an old log jam that has, you know, something. Anyway,
yeah.
The stories are endless.
Yeah, and they're great stories in this book, and that's what I enjoyed about it is that you write with such a conversational tone. There's a charm there, a draw there that I just enjoyed. This gift for storytelling that you obviously have, is that easy to come by for you? I mean, is that something that you think you were born with, say?
I discovered when I was about 8 years old and in school that if you did this thing called extra credit, that you could get your grades raised way up there.
Uh-huh.
And so I hear... Now, the stories in this book are all things I have seen here, you know, living here, obviously. And of course, not all of them are exactly true. There's a couple of stories there that are obviously tall tales.
Sure.
But one fella told me that he remembered when that happened because he was there. And, I mean, it's a total tall tale. You know, set in a setting. No, I have been writing since I was a kid. And my parents supported me so much in everything, anything I did that way or anything artistic. And in fact, in my family, the number of writers is incredible. Did you go to school in Canada?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
You probably read your history book. It's probably called Civilization, Past and Present. By Wabank and Taylor, and Taylor, he's my uncle, and my two uncles are both published authors. One of my cousins had 17 books in print. My sister, my brother-in-law, all have books out. I've got another cousin that's got two books out, one of which is about Lytton, being a ambulance attendant for the Lower Mainland and for Lytton for years.
Uh-huh.
It just kind of comes with the territory. If you want to say something, well, write a story, write a book.
Fried Eggs and Fish Scales is obviously for me an enjoyable book to read. Was it enjoyable for you to write? And I'm assuming you could have had a book twice the size with all the stories that you.
Well, book number two is already almost finished of similar stories,
uh-huh.
with a little bit different slant on it. It's just, you know, when you're sitting around talking with friends, there's good stories. And everybody says, you know, you should write that down. Other people would like that. So there's that way. And then there's a lot of emotion in some of them. There's one that I don't think many people react to about being down in Victoria and listening to the radio during when they were opening Herring. And there was the story about, came on the radio, about a packer trying to make it into Hardy and not making it. And, I mean, we're all right there, you know. Everybody goes dead silent.
Yeah, yeah.
Which boat? Which boat? Who's on it? Does anybody know anybody on the boat? You know, where is so-and-so's son working this year? These are very powerful emotions. So there is that side of it, and then there's just the plain silly side. Do you remember the story about us finding the skiff man dead, tangled up in the engine?
Yeah. he was put there by supposed friends of his, I guess members of the crew, right?
Yeah, 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 they were, and so on. But, I mean, we figured he was good and dead. He was cold and gray. And like I said, my buddy grabbed his feet first, which left me dealing with the head end. He had thick, curly brown hair, so I laced my fingers into the hair in order to twist his neck to get him out from part of the engine he was tangled in.
Yeah.
You know, at which point he says, "Oh, fuck," you know, we drag him into his bunk instead of, you know, to the morgue. But, I mean, as far as we were concerned, he was dead and we had to get him out of there.
Yeah.
And there's also the first year that I was working with a beach man, feigning, there were three guys killed on Johnson Straits who were beach men. And it was my first year, and I did not understand quite as much as I should have, although I was safer than some.
Yeah.
There was danger, there was money, there's a lot of heavy equipment flying around, and one could, you know, make it sound romantic, but it's pretty damn dangerous at the same time.
Yeah, it's real life, isn't it? Because, I mean, there's stories in the book about Molly and Monica.
Mm-hmm.
I guess Molly was your neighbor, or was a tenant.
Yeah.
There's some real life stories there, you know, with those two especially, right?
Absolutely, and there's another character in those tangled up in that, where I got a call not long ago from somebody who said, "Is that character so-and-so?" And I said, "Yeah." Oh, shit. I wondered what happened, you know. So on and so forth. There's a bunch of the guys that are dead,
mm-hmm.
Andy and Greg, we don't even know what happened to. They found, the boat, but didn't find them. And things like that where, yeah, well, that is what happens sometimes. Other things where somebody was almost rescued.
Yeah.
And I some of those, there's, if there's people around who still were deeply involved, I don't write those stories. I have them here, but you know, I won't. Same thing with where I say really nasty things about somebody. If they have much family left, I won't.
Right, right.
You know, that there's no point in causing pain.
Yeah.
But certainly some of the stories in book number two, there are more stories like this coming. I'm worried about. I'm trying to make them of a slightly different nature, so it's not just more of the same.
Right.
But I'm always surprised that people find the book to be humorous. A lot of people talk about how funny it is. So
yeah.
And one guy, his wife called me up and said, you know, Pat doesn't remember that story, and so I told it more at length. And I could hear him screaming in the background, laughing and laughing and laughing. Oh, my God, right,
yeah.
You know. Or I've read some people that were about them, and I'm reading the story to them, and they're saying, oh, wait a minute, I was there. You're talking about me. You betcha. And then they will say, but that's not what happened. And I'll say, no, this is what I saw while you were doing it.
Yeah,
you know, of course, it looks different.
It does, yeah. We'll await that second book definitely, because this book is just a wonderful book, and it is funny, and it does tug on the heartstrings, and there are unfortunate episodes as well. But it is, yeah. I mean, that's life itself, isn't it? I so appreciate your time today. It's so such a pleasure to talk to you, John.
Well, you know, as you may have guessed, I seem to enjoy talking myself. it's been very, very, very fun, and naturally, I would sit here and talk to you all day. So,
we'll talk again when the next book comes out. How's that?
That'll be really good.
Yeah. Thanks for this, John.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Bye bye.
The book is called Fried Eggs and Fish Scales, Tales from a Sointula Troller. It's from Harbor Publishing. Its author, John Taylor, joined me from Sointula back in June in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plantum.